Best on Radio 4, Thinking Aloud with Laurie Taylor. Later, he'll be talking about gardening, but first, he's hitched up his wagon and he's heading out west.
This land has a name today and is marked on maps. But the names and the marks and the land all had to be one. One from nature and from primitive man. Five generations ago, a mere 175 years back, this land was known only as the West. Known only to a handful of white men, more Indian than the Indians in all but blood. They held to no law but their own.
Yes, my own rather alarming version of Spencer Tracy's introduction to the sprawling cowboy epic, How the West Was Won. God, I really do miss Western movies. You remember the simple pleasure of slumping back in a cinema seat at the local Regent or Isolde, and knowing that for the next 90 minutes you were going to watch another wonderfully predictable morality play, in which the baddies and the goodies were always clearly distinguished, in which truth always overcame duplicity, and in which the hero always emerged triumphant from the final shootout. The American West, where savagery met civilization and boys became men. But where did that story come from in the first place? How much did it owe to myth and how much to fact? Why and how and when did it begin to lose its grip on our imagination, its place in our cinemas? Well, just some of the questions which are tackled in a new book called The American West, Competing Visions. And its authors are Karen Jones and John Wills. They're both lecturers in American history at the University of Kent, and they now join me in the studio. Karen, let's go back to the starting point of this myth of the American West. You, and I'm probably using the collective you during most of this conversation, but you date this, I think, back to an early 19th century expedition, right at the beginning of the century, prompted by President Jefferson. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely, yeah. The expedition you refer to is, of course, the Corps of Discovery, led by Captains Lewis and Clark. And certainly, if you look at the end of the 19th century, the closure of the frontier, it's this expedition that people look to.
What were they doing on the expedition?
They were looking for the elusive Northwest Passage. They were looking to forge commerce with both the indigenous residents of the West and also to find a waterway to the Pacific. This whole scheme was conceived by Thomas Jefferson.
So they were discovering Indian nations, presumably, on their trip.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, to use a cliche, Lewis and Clark were going where no Americans had been before, even though obviously the Spanish and the Brits and the French had been there earlier on. But yeah, they forged connections with more than 50 different native nations. Jefferson advised Lewis and Clark to behave in a conciliatory way towards the indigenous peoples that they encountered. You know, this is 29 people travelling 8,000 miles across a continent, so behaving in a kind of belligerent manner is not going to get them very far.
I've always been a bit confused about where the West is, because perhaps this is part of the myth that is rather like, you know, Ruritania. But where is the West? What counts as the West?
Sure. One historian famously said that the West is whatever the Western historian wants it to be, which is quite good when you're a Western historian to have that latitude. But thinking in geographical terms, there are various different boundaries we can work with. We can talk about everything beyond the Mississippi. We can talk about west of the 98th meridian, which is a line which marks aridity, and so talks about the kind of environmental parameters of a West. But for me, I guess, as well as its fuzzy geographical boundaries, the West is a redolent concept.
Yeah.
And its presence.
And people weren't settling then, were they? When this original trip, I mean, we're talking about 1804
to 6.
And people weren't settling when they arrived. They were just prospecting. They were looking around, seeing what
they were. Yeah, I mean, Lewis and Clark had an impact in encouraging a fur trade. Yeah. But the fur trade tended to hit the West, grab what pelts he could. This wasn't a permanent settlement enterprise. It's in the, really with the 1840s, that settlers in mass numbers begin to use the Oregon Trail, the California Trail, to get to the Willamette Valley in Oregon for farming, and of course the gold fields in California.
Let me bring in your co-author, John. Let's, in talking about the origins of this myth, I mean, Karen's very nicely set out those first stages. You also ascribe quite an degree of importance to Frederick Jackson Turner's frontier thesis. And can you explain this and where it came from, what it was all about?
Yes, well, Frederick Jackson Turner provides his frontier thesis back in 1893 at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago to a group of American historians. And he sells this idea, and at the time it doesn't go down
too
well.
What is this exposition? Is this a celebration of...
It's a world exposition of, like, technology, culture. There are shows there. There's a Midway Plaisance, which is a collection of, like, fairgrounds and novelties. There are state museums exhibits. It's a very wide...
So Turner comes along and says this is a wonderful new opportunity. Is that what he talks about?
He really is reflecting on the end of the century, and whereas the rest of the Columbian Exposition is often looking forward, new technologies, Turner's looking backwards and suggesting that now we've finished the frontier of the West. And he suggests that during that process of moving westwards in the 19th century, we became true Americans, that by overcoming the wilderness, by leaving behind our sophisticated or European ways and actually kind of making ourselves over on the frontier, we became true individuals.
True pioneers.
True pioneers, yeah. Exactly.
And of course you had the interesting thing that going on outside this exhibition, you've got entertainment being provided by Buffalo Bill, which, as you say, nicely replicates the accounts which are being given by Turner.
Yeah, we have this curious incident whereby Turner's actually invited to see Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, which is playing just outside the Columbian Exposition, and the two men are both, in a sense, storytellers or entertainers, whereas Turner's using conventional kind of paper means and describing this wonderful Americanization process, and selling the farmer, really, the white farmer, as the pioneer. Buffalo Bill is instead talking about the frontier as being made by the bullet rather than the plow. It's all about glory in terms of conquering Native Americans.
And Karen, Buffalo Bill, he took this image around the world, I think Queen Victoria rather liked
it. Yeah, he played, in fact, in many places around the UK, he took this show, which was incredibly popular. It was, you know, the broadcasting of the myth to a popular audience in the days before television and the movies.
This all rugged individualism and the triumph of...
Absolutely. So you have, you know, wagon trains ambushed by Indians and cavalry riding in to save the day, led by Buffalo Bill, of course, because he's an arch promoter.
So there we have sort of some of the familiar ingredients already of film, sort of Hollywood's version of the American West back in the 30s. Tell me about... Can we sort of say what began the cinematic obsession with the Western, right, if we go back right to the 30s?
I think that the Western draws very much upon the entertainment spectacle that people like Buffalo Bill do promote, in that you have the ingredients there of fast-moving stampedes, wild horses, and an action format that makes very good... movement into modern Hollywood, whereby, you know, you don't necessarily need a detailed narrative or talk, you know, much talk. You know, you want the action.
And no coincidence this genre develops during the time of the Depression.
You know, it provides certainly the B westerns are very popular in the 30s, and they're often about hope and glory, and they're comfort food in a sense during during sometimes difficult times. But they're also massively problematic because of being very ethnocentric.
Yeah, let's I'm going to ask you to ride roughshod over my memories of happy Western films. And what about, and we've got the scalping Indians, the gunfighting cowboys, the white man civilizing the savage. I mean, in your research, what would you say are, if you like, the biggest cliches, the most erroneous myths that are being peddled?
Well, the cowboy, to destroy all your illusions, the cowboy was an itinerant wage labourer, scarcely in control of his own destiny. A third of all cowboys, in contrast to the John Wayne heroic figure, a third of all cowboys were either Hispanic or African American. And even more alarming, perhaps, quite a few cowboys were actually Indian. So how do you square that?
This is a messy sort of film, isn't it? That I think you suggest, don't you, that the whole business of the gunfight was rather overplayed. There wasn't quite as much gunfight.
Yeah, the ideal of the Western gunfighter and a Wild West that's saturated with glorious violence is actually a construction of the movies and also a construction of towns like Dodge City that created themselves as tourist attractions on the back of this violent West. I mean, there's plenty of Western violence, but it's far less glorious and
I think you suggested that actually the amount of violence varies over time. We do begin to get more violent Westerns as we move towards the 60s, don't we?
Certainly. And if you look at the sort of cultural imprint of Vietnam, that really does make a massive impact on the Western as filmmakers are looking to make contemporary social comment in things like The Wild Bunch, notably, and those sort of uber-violent Western movies.
And then it begins to die out. It almost seemed to just suddenly go. One day there were Westerns everywhere, and the next day everything seemed to disappear from the television screens and the cinema screens. John, what happened? We're talking probably about the 70s, are we?
Yeah, 70s is seen as a conventional point of the ending of the Hollywood Western, and it also John Wayne dies in 1976, and that's also seen as part of, you know, linked to this death of the Western. And so some people would suggest that actually the Western lives on in different genres. So, for example, Star Wars is seen as a space Western. So, you know, the actual settings may change, but, you know, there are still kind of the same villains.
What I
want
to ask you both, I don't know, I'll look at you, Karen, but does it end simply because it's been going on for so long? I think you have a figure here of something like 8,000 movies. Are people just fed up with it? Or is it a new cultural sensitivity? Is it a new historical awareness?
I think there is a point of saturation that once you've seen, well, not for me, because I could watch Westerns all day, but for some people, if they watched several Westerns, they may be looking for something fresh, something edgy, something more contemporary, something that speaks more to their era. But having said that, there's an interesting juxtaposition in the late 70s, because although you have the decline of the Western, Ronald Reagan is elected on the back of his cowboy persona, so there's still a role.
Was there a question, because one hears the word genocide thrown around a great deal to talk about the talk about what happened to the Native American population. Does your research suggest that's an appropriate term? Are we talking about ethnic cleansing here?
It's an incredibly contested question. I mean, you're talking about, since 1492, a population decline of something like 90%, a land seizure of something like 90%. You can point to flashpoints in the history of the West, Sand Creek, Wounded Knee, where particular individuals definitely showed genocidal inclinations. Equally, if you look at the reservation system, the idea of cultural cleansing, of killing the Indian, saving the man, all of that is infused with a kind of
ethnocentrism. So, John, this seems enough to make us say that really we find it rather difficult to go and watch a Western now, knowing what we do know. Even if we're not going to call it genocide, knowing what we know makes it impossible to sit and watch any longer.
Yeah, I think that knowing that can make the easy good and bad stories of old Westerns quite.
But they haven't gone away, have they? Because I mean, you're still in theme parks and video games. You point out we've still got they live on there.
Yeah, in a sense, fresh technology basically preserves an old chimera that we have these new entertainment mediums keeping alive outdated stories and keeping alive the Western format, and sometimes actually reducing it further, making it even simpler in terms of video games, definitely.
But there's not much life left in it, Karen, last word?
There's always room for another Western. Before I sound like...
Well, we've had postmodern Westerns, haven't we? Westerns commenting upon Westerns.
Yeah,
we've had homosexual Westerns, we've had Brokeback Mountain. I think you say that could have got an Oscar if it hadn't been for the homosexual theme. Nobody was ready for a gay cowboy.
Some people have argued that, even Hollywood, liberal Hollywood, isn't ready for a gay cowboy. But certainly there were gay cowboys on the real frontier.
Okay, thank you. It's a fascinating book. Thank you very much for talking to me, John Wills and Karen Jones. Now, I've always rather revelled in the autolycan tendencies displayed by listeners to this programme, their capacity to snap up unconsidered trifles. Now, consider the response to the little joke, very, very little joke, that I told last week. White Horse goes into a bar and the barman says, "Good heavens, we've got a drink named after you." And the White Horse says, "What? Eric?" Now, you might have thought that the kindest response to that would have been silence, but you'd have reckoned without Eric Tomlinson. Nice that you closed the programme with the old joke about the horse which went into the pub. I first heard it 30 years ago, and at that time the horse's name was Eric. It is comforting in this era of uncertainty that there's a degree of consistency. And you also have missed out on Alan Saunders. Laurie, I was fascinated by this week's joke because it's one of my favourites. Why is the horse always called Eric? Is it an intrinsically funnier name for a horse than any other? I've heard it told hundreds of times over 30 years, and the horse is always called Eric, even though Eric as a name is much less popular nowadays, and White Horse whiskey has all but disappeared in my area. I think this is a suitable subject for further study. I agree with you, Alan. In fact, when I first tried to recall the joke, the name Derek came to mind, but I knew it just wasn't right. It wasn't funny. It's only when I remembered Eric... did the humour return? There you are, then. It's an open invitation to theorise. Why must the White Horse be called Eric? Off you go. Here are our addresses. Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London, W1A, 1AA. Or you can email us at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. If you want to hear the programme again, find further reading, sign up for my newsletter, or downcast our podload, all you've got to do is go to this website and click through. bbc.co.uk/Radio 4.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering grass, the trees don't have to know. No, no. Why tell them all your secrets? Who kissed there long ago? Whispering grass, the trees don't need to know.
Yes, the ink spots in their inimitable falsetto, asking the grass not to please whisper secrets to the trees. Well, that's a modest example of the attribution of human characteristics to nature. Anyone who's ever listened to people talking about their plants may be able to come up with other examples. My own mother, who had a tendency to wilt herself, was always on the watch out for signs of similar deterioration in her cut flowers. Those daffs have seen better days, Lawrence. Those narcissi seem to have given up the ghost. But was my mother and the multitude of gardeners who use human terms to describe their plants merely speaking only as if plants were people, using simple metaphors, or might these descriptions and accounts say something more about the relationship between people and plants and nature? That's a suggestion which is put forward in an article in the Journal of the Royal Anthropological Society by Catherine Dagnan called On Vegetable Love: Gardening, Plants and People in the North of England. And Catherine, who lectures in social anthropology at Newcastle University, now joins me in the studio. Catherine, just before we talk about your research into how gardeners talk about their plants, let's just start off by discussing the ideas about the relations between humans and nature which you find unsatisfactory. You go back, I mean, you particularly call upon, among other people, E.P. Thompson.
Mm.
So tell me what E.P. Thompson is saying and suggest why you disagree.
Okay, well, I have quite a lot of respect for E.P. Thompson, and particularly one of the ideas that he puts forward about the different relationships that people in particular kinds of societies have with time. So, for example, he compares non-Western societies where time is measured perhaps in relationship to the tide or the sun or one's animals to relationship with relationship with time in increasingly industrialised capitalist society, where time becomes a commodity.
So we move away from using the passage of the seasons, the movement of the moon and the sun to decide where we are, what we are, what time of the day it is. We move to clocks.
That's right.
This is a divorcing from nature.
Yes, yes, that's how.
So nature is on one side and we are on the other, as it were. And then you also look at some of those medical anthropologists who've been writing more recently than E.P. Thompson, who've drawn the distinction between Western and non-Western cultures. Tell me what their argument is.
Well, in fact, this is where I start to have a little bit of a disagreement with the literature. This is a fascinating body of work that has compared the relationship that people in non-Western societies might have with nature. A very embodied sense of relationship with place, a kind of...
Give me some example of that, the way...
Well, for example, a group that Shepherd Hughes and Locke talk about living in the Andean mountains, a community that very much relates the health of an individual and the health of the community to the health of the mountain that they live nearby. So a landslide, for example, is seen as a sign of ill health both for the environment but for the people living at the...
So bodies and nature are much more intertwined.
Exactly.
Now, let's turn to your research, because this is where you talk to gardeners about their plants. You say at the beginning of this, it is peculiar that the whole business of gardening has been so much overlooked by researchers.
Yes, well, anthropologists have long-standing and very excellent work with gardeners and people's ideas of plants, but these tend to be based, again, in non-Western settings. There's a small body of work that has been done in Western settings by social scientists on people's relationships with plants, trees and gardens, but it tends to be overlooked and not taken as seriously as it could be.
And it is, I mean, there's an enormous amount of money being spent on gardening, an enormous amount of gardening programs, but not looked at. What did you do in your research then?
I was very lucky. I got to spend long periods of time over a period of 12 months working with gardeners, both professional gardeners, amateur gardeners, in home gardens, allotments, historical gardens as well.
I shouldn't imagine it was difficult to get them talking.
No.
Did you guide them at all? Or these were open-ended discussions?
They're very open-ended discussions and very much based in practical everyday activities. So I spend a lot of time doing what anthropologists call participant observation, working side by side with the people that you are nominally studying.
You were helping, you were gardening with
them. I was. I learned many, many things from them, and great pleasure in that.
And so tell me some of the things that you found out. I mean, what you were interested in was the way they talked about their plants, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. Well, some of the things that emerged from the research were the very special techniques that gardeners have, which we consider everyday forms of knowledge, that reveal wonderful sets of parallels between human bodies and plants. So, for example, gardeners would talk about certain plants that had a tendency to go berserk, so they needed to be reined in, and other plants that were lazy and they needed to be trained. So wonderful sets of associations.
But you want to say that this isn't a sort of anthropomorphism. You don't really like that term, and you don't like the idea that these are just metaphors that people are
using.
That's
right. I think it's very easy to listen to language like this and to observe practices like the ones that I did in the gardens and just stop at that point and say, oh, this is just... People are just speaking as if plants are humans, but we all know, really, that there's a great divide between the human world and the natural world. I think if you start to unpick these things and look at them in more detail, it becomes quite clear that Westerners, like non-Westerners, are very much more enmeshed in the natural world.
Yeah,
the metaphor permits space for.
Because you want to say that the fact that they ascribe intentionality to the plants and the behaviour of plants suggests that something more than metaphorical talk is going on.
Very much more. There's a writing of human social relationships onto plants and onto gardens. There's sort of a sense of intimacy, nearly, that one perceives and sees happening in the gardens and in the care that's being tended on the plants, but also the ways in which plants are spoken of and treated. It seems to exceed the simple divide between mechanistic Western worldview and plants as part of something separate.
And you enrich this argument by reference to the role that plants play in the autobiographies, in people's autobiographies. Mm. Tell me a little more about that.
In fact, I think this is a real linchpin for understanding my argument. One example of the role plants can have in biography comes from a friend that I made through this period of research, and she told me a story of a rose bush. This was a rose that originally was in the garden of her friend's mother, and she would go have dinner with this friend and her mother every week whilst they were both young working women. And when my friend then was about to become married, she was gifted a cutting of this rose bush, and she just absolutely treasured this and took it with her as a young married woman, and from house to house kept transplanting the rose, kept nurturing it, looking after it. And the plant actually moved with them from home to home over many, many decades. And there are multiple examples like the rose story from other gardeners.
I must say, when I hear a lot of gardening programmes, though, there doesn't seem to be quite a emphasis on control, you know, that idea of division. How can I get rid of these pests? How can I manage this? How can I clear that out? How can I chop that down? How can I make this happen? But in your gardener's talk, you didn't hear too much of that.
Well, there were some pesky plants that needed reining in and needed controlling, and weeds that were always a little bit out of place. But there was also a great deal of sympathy and empathy with the lives and wants and desires of these creatures that were seen to have their own intentions.
And were people very happy to talk to you about this, or were they surprised that here you were, an academic anthropologist, coming along talking to them about something they'd taken for granted?
I think that people have so much pleasure in and from gardening that they want something that they want to share, and I'm sure the anthropologist arriving on the scene always startles people a bit. But my interest was genuine, and I think they sensed that, and very quickly became a shared interest and shared passion. So we had some wonderful discussions. Yes,
I think all the gardeners listening to this programme will be delighted that their status has been somewhat raised by what you've got to say. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Catherine Degnan, thank you very much. And as this week's footnote, I want to remind you of a joke. I think it's a joke which rather perfectly captures when the traditional Western came of age. I'm looking at John and Karen. It's the Lone Ranger and Tonto get surrounded by hundreds of armed Indians. They're already nodding. The Lone Ranger says, "It looks like we've had it this time, Tonto." And Tonto replies, "What do you mean, we?"
Thinking Aloud was presented by Laurie Taylor. The producer is Charlie Taylor. And there's lots more on the website. You can sign up for the Thinking Aloud podcast. You can read Laurie's newsletter. You can contact the programme, or you can explore the archives. Just go to bbc.co.uk/radio4 and follow the links to Thinking Aloud. We look at the stigma and secrecy traditionally surrounding the menopause in just a moment. Am I Normal is next. Then in half an hour, it's PM. Here's Eddie Mayer.
Germany has suffered another school shooting. There are many dead. The gunman managed to escape the school and carry on killing elsewhere. We'll have more details. Also in the programme, the sound of silence as thousands of people in Northern Ireland demonstrate against recent killings. We'll hear from France about a change in that country's attitude to NATO. And staying in France, why not? We'll ask whether winemakers are right to be going purple over rosé. All that, plus Nils with upshares and a word about product placement. Join me if you can at 5.
Thanks, Eddie. First, on Radio 4, it's time for Am I Normal? This week, Vivian Parry looks at what happens at the menopause, an experience that varies greatly amongst women.